if I were talking to, let's say, the CFTC or the SEC or the Bank of England, any of them are the same, and I said, look, my security is better than yours, these regulators, they'll all say, oh, yeah, yeah, totally, I agree. Yeah, I mean, they're on thin ice. They're stressed out. They know not only is it really hard for them to staff, to buy tooling, forget about it. They're going to get a new contract for the latest SEM or whatever? Absolutely not.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial?
Adversarial.
It's time to get adversarial.
Hey guys, welcome back. Great to see you guys as always. Another episode of the Adversarial Podcast. This is a bit of a milestone for us. We're right at 1 year doing this together. I think that's awesome. I've been having a blast. Congrats to you guys and myself. I think it's been a lot of fun. What do you guys think when you reflect? You know, how's this year been? Sunil?
There's an adage in when you raise kids, the days are long, but the years are short.
Yeah, absolutely. How about you, Mario? Yeah, absolutely. How about you, Mario?
Oof, so many things. It started right after I've left Snowflake, and within a couple of months, 2-3 months, there was a whole security story around Snowflake customers. That was kind of a little bit interesting. And I was in kind of this whole, experiencing how to do these things on YouTube or on doing this online.
Yeah, but I'll tell you though, Jerry, it's been great. I'm sure you've heard this too. We walk around in different conferences and people just say, hey, I love your podcast. I'm like, wow, that's great. It's good to hear that people are enjoying what we have to say. Hopefully we can continue to offer some interesting insights as the podcast continues.
Yeah, I agree. And I definitely get a whole lot of it spurs conversation. You know, people are like, hey, I mean, like, it's when you listen to a good podcast, you think, oh, crap, I have something to add to that, or I wish they knew this. And I get a lot of those types of things, and it turns into great conversations with people. And, you know, part of retiring as a CISO 3 years ago now is you think about how you're going to stay in touch with the community, and this is just such a great way to do that. I think it's been really good. Hey, you know, funny anecdote, speaking of that, retiring 3 years ago, I went up to my alma mater today, a few hours ago, to celebrate the retirement of a guy that worked for me for since 2008 or whatever. You guys do the math on that. And man, I figured I wouldn't know anybody there, but they're doing a great job because I must have known 60% of the people there. Like, everybody's sticking around and has been for 5, 10, 20. There's 25 year folks that were still there too. So that was a lot of fun. And one of the guys there is, a lot of them listen to the podcast. One of them was giving me tips on promoting it, marketing and all that.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of fun to see it. It's really a connector. That's good. All right, let's get into it. Sunil and I came from financial services, so we often bias towards that. We're going to do a little bit of those topics today, but hopefully they'll be applicable to just about everyone. We're going to talk a little bit about some changes in rulemaking from regulators, some pressure on regulators via Treasury. We'll be talking about AI as usual. There's a couple of interesting, I would say, like, anecdotes that draw more attention to how we're handling security in the AI era. And then finally, I'm going to, at a minimum, complain a little bit about some new pattern around file sharing. So that's what everybody has to look forward to. Kicking it off. So there was an article that came out covering, I think it's pretty cool. It was banks challenged Treasury on cybersecurity failures. And basically, there was a few financial services industry orgs. FSISAC was not in that, which I was sad to see. I find it hard to think that they didn't ask FSISAC, and I feel like it's more likely they did, and somebody just like, I didn't want to be in the political fray. Don't put me on the record. And I think it's a shame. I think this would be a good risk to take. But the other industry orgs challenged Treasury. So they basically wrote a letter. Treasury's not a regulator, right? But they're a sector-specific agency, and they're an interface to the regulators. And basically said, look, regulators, I'm paraphrasing here. You guys wind me back in if I'm overdoing it. They said, regulators keep getting hacked. We're tired of exposing our data via, rule of law to these regulators. They come and audit everything, and then they lose our data when they get hacked here. We think that we should change the way that we're doing things. And I was a little bit, I was involved in that conversation many times over the years. And I thought the wrong way to go down that road was you need to get more secure, because there's no magic. If everybody knew how to get more secure, we wouldn't have jobs, right? And I knew what was going to happen to that. It was going to be some overarching legislation. It was going to be another FFIEC handbook, but it was going to be just for regulators, and it was going to be years of paperwork and another line of defense. And ultimately, they were going to say, look, we followed the handbook. Now you have to show us all your data. And I thought, the real problem is no one wants to work for you, regulators. High turnover, a huge workforce, a lot of onerous rules that require you to have fair access. It's just a Sisyphean effort for you to be secure. So I was always a big proponent of, let us not share the data with you in person. I mean, electronically. Force you to come on site, look at all you want. Don't put it in your systems. I argued that with a lot of regulators directly, and they were sympathetic. And they said, good, yeah, I don't want it either. Meet me in D.C., meet me in New York, meet me in Chicago, meet me in London, and that's good enough. And I'll go to your office, and if you let me spend 2 weeks straight on site looking through stuff, give me a dedicated terminal, all that. And we did all that. That's the way the letter went, and they pushed for that too. I think that's really fair and really good. Well, what do you guys think about this push?
Yeah, so I think the basic premise of reducing the general premise is reduce my attack surface, don't increase it. You know, the security principle at play. And if there's some interaction, if the goal here for Treasury is to reduce not just the cybersecurity attack surface, but, you know, the financial attack surface, like what are the potential problems that may occur? The reason why people attack Treasury is not really actually to steal money from Treasury. It is actually to get this kind of content that gives them market advantage in some way, right? And if that market advantage, if the attack surface associated with the kind of content that's shared increases one's advantage, then that's not a net positive in the end, right? So I think if we just basically apply the general principle of decrease my attack. If I'm doing an assessment on somebody, decrease my attack surface, don't increase it. That principle has utterly failed in the current model. And I think the challenge that the banks are issuing to the Treasury takes that principle and says, let's live that out for real.
You know, I'm just going to say I'm a fish out of water right now when it comes to this this vertical. Can you guys clarify for me, and maybe for our audience as well, what is the kind of data that these folks are collecting? Do you mind, like, just giving?
Sure.
I'm not familiar.
Yeah. So Jerry can probably give you some more specifics on what data is being provided, but let me generalize it as well. Okay. So, like, one of the things that we do is stress tests to see how resilient we are to different financial shocks. So we have lots of data around like what our capital reserves are. It's really detailed financial data on our cash positions and credit risks that we have and all these different things that
for the banks. These are for banks, right? These are for banks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. And so it gives you a really detailed health of the institution. Okay. But as you may imagine, that's also extraordinarily sensitive, like market sensitive. And again, Jerry can provide some additional insights, but that's the gist of it. But let me generalize it for a moment. And let me get to, I think the reason why I thought this was interesting for the broader audience is we do this already within security, and it's called third-party risk management, okay? So what is it that we do? At a much smaller scope, there's much more really interesting data that we're giving Treasury. But at some level, through these third-party risk management surveys that we get, what is it that we're actually doing? We're giving to another party, in theory, all the juicy details about our security environment, okay? Now, let me give you some perspectives that one can consider. Let's suppose the data that we give them is practically useless, okay, to another attacker. Okay, in other words, we fill out this third-party risk management questionnaire, and the attacker looks at it and says, this is crap, which we all know, of course. This is not going to help me attack this other organization. What does that say about the questionnaire one? Okay, But let's suppose it actually is useful. Why would we want to turn that over to another party so that an attacker can attack them and you know, find paths or keys into our environment? Either way, my point hopefully is you can see how this sort of perspective of, hey, you know what? Why am I giving this over to you? If you really want to know this, come to my environment. You can look at it in my environment. And we can do it in a way that really contains it. You know, there's things like Safebase and other environments where the data does go over there. But the I think there's better models that we can use to say, look, we have really, if you want to know what my security environment looks like, it's really, I mean, there's a lot of sensitive details that I don't want in your hands. Thank you very much. So if you want to know it, come over here. I'll show it to you, tell you everything you need to know, but you don't leave with it.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, and so like when I was painting the whole thing and saying, I mean, if I were talking to, let's say, the CFTC or the SEC or the Bank of England, any of them were the same, and I said, look, my security is better than yours. I mean, if I said that to you, Mario, when you were at Snowflake, I mean, you'd have a pretty good argument. Like, I don't know, Jerry, you know, mine's pretty good. But these regulators, they'll all say, oh, yeah, yeah, totally. I agree. Yeah, I mean, they're on thin ice. They're stressed out. They know how hard it is to hire, even for us. And we're paying top dollar and they're not. And then on top of that, not only is it really hard for them to staff, to buy tooling, forget about it. They're going to get a new contract for the latest SEM or whatever. Absolutely not. But then on top of that, because of the watering hole attack, the customer targeting threat objective, they're even more targeted than we are. Because like, why would you come after Bank A for Bank A's data when you can go after this regulator and get Bank A through Z, get them all in one shot, served up and organized in a nice little file format. Now, back to your question about what they have, like Sunil gave a really good response about the non-cyber data. And by the way, that's not even on the table. Like, I think when it comes to regulation over like capital structure and waterfalls and like how you would liquidate portfolios and all of that, the people that are receiving those examination requests and document requests from regulators, they wouldn't dare even think about challenging canning that over. I mean, they're not worried about it getting hacked. They're just, oh man, the Fed asked for this. Give it to them now. Rush, 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 boom. I think they should be in the same boat too, but they're not even in this conversation. They're just still rolling over and will be for a long time. The only ones pushing back are the CISOs and the, you know, there's different regs within, whether it's the SEC or all the FFIEC consortium or the CFTC. A lot of those have regs that are kind of over the business side of it. Are you running fair and orderly markets, that sort of thing? And then over the cyber, which is technical control programs like TCP, that kind of thing. And that's where this conversation is. And it the way these exams work, you have code, you have regs, and they generally say, you need to notify us if something goes bad. You need to have certain controls. And you know, there's a few things. You need to do some testing and some of the better ones. And then when they do an exam, they give you a whole document request, and it's like TPRM, you know, if they didn't just nod when you sent the questionnaire back. Like, just imagine if they actually poked it at the questionnaire. Thank God companies don't, but the regulators do. And so there, I remember there were things in there like, give us an org chart of everybody related to security with their names. I mean, show me a dump of all the user IDs that have access to any sensitive system. I mean, how stupid is that, right?
Yeah.
Like, and we would say, forget about where you see it. You shouldn't even ask for that. You should never ask anybody to come. I mean, literally the, you know, the MDuarte-7. Like, they want to know the login IDs.
Let me play devil's advocate, though, now that I'm hearing you about this stuff.
Okay.
But plain devil's advocate for the sake of plain devil's advocate, because one, I completely agree with all of you guys on this. But I also recognize that the regulators, I mean, as maybe mean things we say some of these about these regulators, they are people really trying to do a lot of dirty, hard work
for very little
pay, and God bless their soul. And I don't mean that in a southern way, right?
But you also don't mean it in a San Francisco way.
Yeah. So, I was thinking, if you have a regulator who is going to be on the take with the financial companies and they're going to visit you. Yeah, they spend 2 weeks with you. How do you ensure that one, they did the right job, that they were accurate in their assessment, and that there's basic oversight of the regulator themselves. And again, I am not questioning the regulators or even the financial institutions. I'm just trying to figure out what audit trail we can provide under the conditions that they go visit you only, they look at the stuff and they say, oh yeah, okay, this is how I thought about it. Otherwise, you're going to take screen captures of things or you're going to grab some pieces of paper. No, I know. But then how do you trust the regulator not to be in cahoots with the – again, I am not saying anything about the regulators. I'm just playing devil's advocate. So
I think it's I want to hear from you guys. Great point. Never say it again. Let's hide this and never go to Washington and share that. Now, it's a really, really valid point. I've heard that with Big Four, right? Because we've done the same thing with Big Four. And they say, I need to have my work papers, right? Because they're technically regulated by AICPA and they're held to standards and they could be audited. And are you doing something good? Which is great in general for the industry. And the way they would defend it is through the work papers, especially if you think about like financial audit. We reached this conclusion. Here's the data that was fed into the machine. So they could make that argument. I hadn't heard that pushback much. Again, I haven't seen the regulators saying, no, 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 I want the data. I think what they really were asking for was air cover, so they probably love this motion because they didn't want to hold the data either. I mean, if somebody brought that up, I think the answer would be somewhere in the middle. It would be somewhere where you're making notes about, I reviewed the username list, I did not find anything that was out of order, and versus here's the actual username list so you could re-perform the work later on. It's a judgment call. I hope that the cyber risk angle would prevail over the re-performance of work angle.
Going back to the AICPA, if there's one redeeming quality of SOC 2, it's that they ask for evidence, but the evidence is not like, doesn't have to be, here's a dump of all my usernames, right? It's just enough to be able to demonstrate that you're following whatever policies and things that you've attested to. That's about the only redeeming aspect of SOC 2 I think I can offer on this call, but on this podcast. But that said, I think the work papers in this regard is really, yeah, just here's the evidence and I've done my due diligence.
Yeah. And you know, I think like, while I feel a little guilty when we double dive on financial services type topics, you guys were right to bring up the parallel to TPRM because this is the same thing going on, right? So when ICE was reviewing Snowflake, I know we were a lot different than everyone else in the world, but when Bank of America was reviewing Snowflake, sorry to throw you on a bus, Sunil, it was a 300-question questionnaire, and it was, we demand you send all this stuff, and we want to see your latest pen test, and on, and all that stuff. And it's a leverage game, and when you were the startup, you're like, send them the stuff, please, don't slow down or whatever. When Bank of America was doing the same thing to ICE, I was on the call like, no, you're not going to see our pen test results. Here's the actionable items that came out of it. Here's the status on remediation of them. You're not going to get to the details of it. That took a lot of pushback, and I knew that they were a captive audience. I had some leverage.
Yeah.
But if I were Snowflake, especially in the early days, they would have walked and moved on. So, I mean, I think it's good precedent to get this going on in the public-private sector relationship, and then maybe it'll apply, too, to the private-private sector.
But it's interesting you guys say that because, we did share pen test reports with many of you, with any of the customers who requested it.
Yeah.
But what we did is we made it really – in fact, a lot of the financial companies got upset at us because it required for them to open a proxy. Why? Because we wanted to make sure we knew. We were using some software. By the way, it didn't do too well, the company. But the software was basically track where the document was going and whether the document was being copied or printed or who it was shared with. That's right. And share with – both of your points, this is really juicy, valuable information that under the wrong hands could have compromised Snowflake potentially. I'm not saying it would, but potentially.
Yeah, you would kind of hope so. Otherwise, it was a kind of a crappy pen test if it didn't have something juicy. So, funny anecdote here. I remember being in – so we used to do and I still advocate for this through adversarial. We advocate for a CyberGov. We use the same term, Cybersecurity Privacy Governance Committee. Cross-functional, right? GC, CFO, all that. And I think every quarter that audience should be in there and your materials that come out of cyber program should be enough so that they're willing to show up every week and not blow it off, just to put it succinctly. And one of the things that we talked about back at ICE during a CyberGov meeting, was, I mean, there was always like a pretty, you want some pretty structure and all that, but as a CISO, it was tempting to show off every now and then and show, look at this cool thing we did this quarter or whatever. And inevitably, you'd get burned on that and you would be like, never do that again, Jerry. And then I would do it again the next quarter, right? It would be a different topic, but I thought I was going to impress everybody. So this particular quarter, I brought in what we had baked pretty heavily. So I came up with, you know, the classic like dumps. Today it's InfoStealer, but it's been the same forever. The classic cred dump shows like user HTTP colon slash slash username colon password at and then at fully qualified domain name, right? And this is like, I mean, that technically would work with certain types of authentication, but also it is a good way to just kind of share credentials. So we would implant a string like that into documents we were going to submit to regulators. And we generate a unique credential pair for each regulatory submission. And we'd record a little table of that back at home. So we would send a little username password pair. It would be like in the footer, like in a lighter color text, like, oops, we accidentally shared. And we knew regulators were never going to ask, but if they did, we would tell them what we were doing. And the idea is anybody ever touches that cred pair, was it honey token, then we'd know that doc got popped, right? And we'd come after them and say, hey, only you had this and somebody in the world has it. Either you're hacking us or what's going on? And we were done with it and ready to go in the document submissions. And by the way, when you're heavily regulated, we had an awesome little project, a script to pull all the docs and put them all in a zip all dynamically. And like, so there was automation and all this. And I showed off about that great idea. And the GC was like, what? You're going to backdoor the government? Hell no. No, shut that down right now. And man, so we didn't actually go to prod with that. And I wished I had never brought it up and asked for forgiveness later because it was badass idea.
That was your mistake. You asked
the lawyer. That was the only mistake. Yeah. We were both risk managers, the GC and I. And I thought I was doing great by taking a little risk there. And yeah.
Hey, you know, it's just like any other tracker that's out there, right?
Well, yeah, that's exactly what it is. I mean, and by the way, that particular regulator did get popped later on. And like the background to all this story for the layperson listening in is that there have been repeated consistent breaches at regulators. I think it was the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC banking regulator, that was one of the more recent ones cited. Mm-hmm. The CFTC had things. I've probably mentioned this before, but the SEC had examiners on site, and one of those guys that was on our site brought a laptop to DEF CON and literally lost it in Vegas at DEF CON. And then they were smart enough to do what we all used to do, which is like, can we prove that it had an encrypted hard drive? And then we can defend not telling anyone because it was encrypted, right? So they went down that road and they affirmatively proved it was not encrypted, the hard drive. So they did write the letter and said, yes, we checked. It was not encrypted. It was lost and it had all your examination data on it. And that was like 15 plus years ago. So this has been a on and on. There's definitely some serious evidence that this leads to woe.
So the notion of a regulator, I want to expand that definition as well. So of course, the regulator is the formally defined regulator, but the other regulators include your supply chain. If you have somebody that you're doing business with and they ask for this kind of content, then they're essentially regulating you as well. Mm-hmm. And then of course, your customers are also your regulators because they can vote with your feet and take you to court and do other things as well. So there are many regulators. There's one that's specifically defined, you know, by official title, so to speak. But we also, if we recognize that our third party, that our part of our supply chain or our customers are also regulators, we have to recognize that what we're asking our formal regulator to do, we should also be asking our customers and our other supply chains to do as well. So the recommendation was enable firms to retain sensitive data within their own secure systems. Mm. I would push this further and say, hey, if you are a startup or trying to do business with a bank, and one of the banks who is a member of SIFMA or a member of
ABA.
ABA or BPI, or you know, whoever wrote this letter, you would say, hey, you know, even your own organization that you're a member of has made the suggestion. Yep. for us to be able to keep our own data and you come over to us. So if you want to really, you know, follow your own words, then
I think that's a great idea. I know exactly how it would go, and it would be, that's not my department. I remember the same, I remember Wells Fargo, specifically at the same time we had two discussions, and one was, we want you to deprecate support for TLS version whatever, let's say version 1.0. And the reason we hadn't was because Wells Fargo couldn't upgrade their clients to negotiate past TLS 1.0. Right, I mean, talk about like left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing, and that's the exact same thing you're talking about. You would tell them, they would just be like, "Yeah, I know, it's not great. Sorry."
I want to add one more before we go on this topic, because now you guys are bringing me memory lane. Here's a memory lane, bringing it back. Okay, you guys ever remember Hacking Exposed? Are you guys old enough to remember those books?
Huh? Yeah. That book. Who wrote that? It was one of our.
Oh, so guys, yeah, it's was George there? George Kurtz.
So anyway,
those guys were part of the, I was part of that team, not that who wrote the book, but I was part of that Security Tiger team. And I'm not going to name the big four, but it was a big four. So it's not just governments. But anyway, if you got the first run of the first editions, you want to probably go look at it, because it's a really interesting story. In one of the examples that they show on how to break into a network, well, they actually use real live actual things that they had collected as auditors. We were going in there to break into our customers' environment. This is back in 1999, 2000. Anyway, so they included in the image of in the book. Names of servers, of all the servers in the network, the domain controllers. You know, it was a Windows environment. And it was one of our clients' domain. It was their domain controllers, their whole network. Fantastic. It was a big client. The customer called the partner of our group, and he was absolutely, absolutely pissed. I think the rumor was that the guys got fired because of that. And so we had to go redo. They had to go redo the book. Yeah, of that Hacking Exposed.
Oh, best thing ever happened to them, right?
Yeah, I mean,
it was Stuart McClure and George Kurtz.
I don't want to throw those guys. Yeah. I'm telling you what.
Oh, they're doing fine.
This is probably I shouldn't say this, but you know, it's been more than 25 years, so I think we're okay. But anyway, so yeah.
Yeah, we rely heavily on statute of limitations here.
But just to Sunil and Jerry's point. It's not just regulators, but you know, these other people that you give your pen test reports. What happens?
Well, you know, it's interesting what you introduced, Sunil. You always introduce something very novel in a different way of looking at it. And this particular one, I've thought about that, and I did it a little bit backwards. So in class, when I teach this, like you were basically saying, like B2B are also, and your supply chain are also your regulators. I say the same thing in reverse, where I say regulators are also a third party. So I say like it's all TPRM. Mm-hmm. And in particular, and you know, this is just some model I made up. It's not necessarily pure and true, but it's useful. And it was, I say, like every one of those third-party relationships has an agreement, a test, and an enforcement. And the agreement with formal regulators is legislative, right? And the agreement with your third parties is contractual, and on. I go all the way down this chain to say there's agreement between the second line and the first line, agreement between security and the employees. Right, and it's the stuff that they sign off on. And if you think about it like that, the enforcement, it's a regulatory exam, it's a TPRM review, it's fish test, it could even be that. And then you can quickly imagine the enforcement is, and it has banks, it has jail on one side and firing people on the other end of that spectrum. But I like the way you're thinking about that, I totally agree. And by the way, the board and management are also mm-hmm. an arm's length third party agreement where you're taking a word for it. All right, great. While we're talking about financial services and regulation nonstop, sorry, that's not the only one we're going to talk about, but there was a headline out about SEC scrapping some cyber rules. In the headline, it says, for investment advisors, space market participants. You know, I think the big takeaway for the layperson in reading this headline is that there are a ton of different tiered regulations. And in particular, when you think about like the RIA designation and agreement test and enforcement, it's if you want to get a license to do something, then you agree to comply with this regulation. And investment advisors is a very specific class that you have to get. I think it's licensed, but it's approved to be a RIA, a registered investment advisor. And I know that's kind of a subclass. It's like below being an exchange, being an actual marketplace. And I always knew, like, FINRA is the regulator for that versus the SEC proper on the exchanges. And we would talk, being in the exchanges, to these RIAs and to FINRA and advise them on rulemaking, because basically they were 6 to 18 months behind the exchanges. And so it was always, we had these rules on us first, and then it would trickle down to them. So when they scrapped these proposed rules, it's funny, but when you looked at the proposal about notification requirements and all that for public companies, there was a few months before or after a parallel rule that was only for these RIAs, these registered investment advisors, that had some of the same things that were going to be in the ones on public companies and so on. It was a little bit lighter. And that's what got scrapped here. And the argument is these are smaller shops. These are ones that don't have a big cybersecurity staff. They don't have what, you know, Bank of America would have had to be able to comply, or the New York Stock Exchange. So I don't think this one being scrapped is a big alarm or anything like that. I think it's more in the fine print of it, but maybe others would feel differently.
Yeah. I think it's a general pattern in this particular administration to release the small guys from more regulation, while keeping some of the big guys being, you know, still regulated, so to speak, to some degree. I think that's the general pattern I've seen, and you hear that. Whether it's in cybersecurity or AI or energy or any market, if you will, a general push to don't stifle innovation, don't stifle, don't overregulate on the small side. And on the big side, we're starting to see some relaxing of some of those rules too, but it follows a certain pattern that I've seen. I would say at the same time, we are currently in a elevated cyber threat environment right now with recent geopolitical events. And so I don't know to what degree there's been a general pullback on the cybersecurity regulations and requirements. And there's even questions about whether the incident disclosure rules that were adopted under, that were pushed under Biden, are going to stay. But I think with Iran being very much more aggressive now, or we should expect them to be more aggressive, it's only going to take a few hacks here and there that become public for them to realize, okay, just the optics would be really bad to start, you know, to pull back more and more.
Yeah, that's true. It's funny. So talking about the Iranian conflict right now, and specifically the U.S. involvement and action in bombing the nuclear sites. I was just talking about it this morning, actually, on a bike ride, and I was just saying, you know, we are in a heightened risk of terrorism right now. And then later I was talking with some colleagues in financial services, and they were talking about, man, it's the CPRM nightmare again. They got the questionnaire saying, what are you guys doing about Iran? You know, I mean, that's what bad security programs do, right? There's news, let's just send some emails to all of our vendors. That'll show them. It's just awful. But here's the best part. They weren't sending them to critical financial infrastructure, which would make perfect sense. What are you doing in Iran? You know, I mean, that's it. They were sending them to mortgage data companies. Mm-hmm. Like, it's about the threat actors have motivations and objectives, right? Iran is undoubtedly pissed off right now. They have a long track record of not forgetting anything that they consider a transgression. And the way they lash out is generally through proxy, through terrorism, through sabotage-style attacks, DDoS. So if you're prominent, if you're associated with capitalism, with Western, with the United States, if you're Bank of America, yeah, it's going to happen.
Just for the record, Bank of America is not the central bank of the United States. Thank you very much, Iran.
If you're explaining, you're losing again, right? Yeah. But I'm more worried flying on planes right now than I am holding mortgage data or whatever. You know, they're not trying to, you know, steal crypto all of a sudden because of the bombs. They're going to lash out and do something sabotage related. That's real.
You know, you guys mentioned the small players, and it makes sense to allow creativity, new ideas to be to come up and show up in the market. So if this is intentional by the administration, the current president's administration, then I applaud them that they should definitely do that. As a startup, I'm a big believer in small companies. But I don't know anything about this particular group that you guys are talking about, Jerry, that this applies to, because the reason I'm saying this is, I kid you not, some of the biggest security audits, and I mean, they really pushed us, drove us, and asked very intelligent questions, and oftentimes drove me mad, were hedge companies. And hedge funds, yeah. So hedge funds had, they may not have, I mean, they have big portfolio, big chunks of money, maybe not the size of the Bank of America, of the actual American country.
Yeah. But, whoever named that thing, that's on them. I can't bail them out.
Yeah, those Italians from San Francisco. Oh, man.
Yeah, it used to be called Bank of Italy. Come on.
Yeah. Anyway, so the hedge funds don't typically have big teams, okay? They're not like these huge teams, but they are technically... Yeah, I guess because they're well funded, they get really talented security.
And they're
experts.
Algos. I mean, most of the time, they're algos. Yeah. I mean, if they're using Snowflake, you know, they were tech forward, yeah. So they were that side of the hedge fund world.
So I'm wondering, when you guys are saying this group that they're targeting right now, they're saying, well, this is not going to be, you know, things that they're the robots you need to look at. What does that mean? How do they compare? Yeah, the droids, exactly.
Well, they are. I think hedge funds would be considered RIAs. But I would guess that what you were seeing there was organic, good, hygienic. Analyze our threat model. Oh, it's our algos. It's our intellectual property. What the hell are we doing with Snowflake? Probably storing things related to those algos, portfolio data that would be used in calculating risk and figuring out what orders to put. And genuinely saying, and I still question like the threat model of, I'm a hedge fund and I'm worried about another hedge fund stealing my algos. Like, I mean, as unscrupulous as financial services can be, I'm not sure anybody would want that on their hands. I think the damage would be far worse than the benefit of stealing someone's algos. But if they said, that's our threat profile, we're worried about our intellectual property, and we're going to store it in this new online database, we damn well want to get comfort with that. I think that's good and noble. If that's what they were after, you know, if they weren't asking you about whether you had a fire extinguisher on every hall and all this checkbox crap, then I think it'd be all right.
I think it was in one of the type of, okay, so the type of data was important, but also how they managed the data and how they, you know, the schemas. I think that's what you're relating to, Jerry. But I think the biggest wow moment for me was that if they were to get compromised, you know, their clients for these hedge funds, some of them really, really want to protect their privacy. They want to make sure that nobody knows who that they're doing business with these hedge funds. They want to be protected, yada, yada, yada. And so the idea that if you were to be compromised, yes, your Snowflake or your Databricks account got compromised, even though it had nothing to do with you, Mr. Client, it would demonstrate to them, the client, that this company is not safeguarding their privacy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I could absolutely see that. So, yeah, it's interesting. All right, we'll move on for a brief moment from financial services and regulation and that sort of thing. It's near and dear to my heart. It's time for the AI segment. Not literally, but there was an interesting article in Fortune here that was about what they guised up as a Microsoft Copilot flaw. And more importantly, they were saying, is that just like a canary in the coal mine here and a harbinger of things to come and so on? Sunil, whether you like it or not, you're our resident AI security expert, and I think we have a very good one here. What do you think about this? Is this something net new? Is this something people should be concerned about?
Well, I think there's a bigger concern around agentic AI as a whole, and what we are seeing here is essentially the what was novel or what was interesting about this attack. It wasn't necessarily the individual components of the attack, because the individual components were all pretty well-known ways to attack LLMs. It was essentially what we see in vulnerability, discovering new vulnerabilities, and exploiting them. It's a chain of attacks, and the chain of attacks is what was particularly interesting here. So again, the individual attack itself wasn't, individual component of the attack wasn't interesting. The chain of attacks was interesting. I think the most interesting aspect of that chain was the initial, well, you know, the initial exploit, right? The initial infection vector, which was an email, but the email was crafted as instructions to the person, not to the machine, but the machine basically still took the, you know, took it as instructions to themselves. And what essentially bypassed was Microsoft's controls against direct instructions to the LLM. So an example would be, one of the examples that they gave was instructions to the employee saying, here's the guide to complete your onboarding. Okay. And then it gave the attack instructions, which the LLM happily followed. So that was interesting that, you know, again, it was sort of like a redirection away from giving instructions to the LLM and giving instructions to the user instead. And somehow, even though it was instructions to the user, the LLM picked it up and ran with it. And the guardrail that was put in place was ones that were directed to the machine. And so, again, when it was directed to the user, it went through.
Wait a minute. So Sunil, let me stop you there. I mean, is this thing going to be the next phishing attack for the future? I mean, it's attacking the logic. So you patch it. You figure out, okay, you know, they did something they shouldn't have done. They plugged the hole. Microsoft did that. Thankfully, they did a great job. Thank you. But are we going to continue? Is there always going to be somebody smarter saying, huh, I'm going to let me exploit the logic here? It feels like a logic attack. Am I wrong? And if I'm right, tell me how to think about
it. Yeah, I think you kind of said it both ways. You're not wrong. You're right. so anyway, the logic attack, there's so many different ways to bypass the guardrails that, and this is not just a Microsoft problem. Guardrails that we have today are full of bypasses. I have no confidence in any of the guardrails that we have that they're, I mean, it's like security, I guess. I can't necessarily say any of our security provisions are 100%, but I can definitely say that it's so evident with when it comes to LLM guardrails. There's so many different ways to essentially social engineer an LLM. And you know, there's companies out there that are trying really hard, and they've gotten better and better. But at the same time, as we know with anyone who's played Gandalf, it's hard to prevent from, even with the newer prompt injection controls, it's still hard to get people to not get to level 8, which is the final level. There's still plenty of people who get to that level because there's still ways around it.
Yeah, and I mean, they have the time, right? I mean, they have the time to invest in it. Like, I always think about that. Like, the adversaries have the time to find the downgrade attacks and find the edge cases and onwards. So if there's anything at all possible, it'll happen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know, like, I use Mario, as a new founder, you may find this interesting or not. I use a service called Puzzle.io for bookkeeping. I like it. I like it a lot. I haven't met the founders and all that yet. I haven't had the time to track
it
down.
I'm going
to
write it right now.
Yeah. When I do, I'm going to try to work my way into investing in it. That's how much I like it. And then I'll have to disclose it. But for now, I just use it. And it's bookkeeping software, right? It emails me. I swipe my Amex, right? I bought some furniture recently and swiped the Amex on Amazon. And I get an email saying, like, so if it was a bookkeeper, hey, there was a transaction for $592 from Amazon. We think it was probably this category, maybe these other three. To categorize it, reply with, and I just copy. And 90% of the time, I take their first suggestion because it's right. And it says reply and say that the category should be, and I just copied it, the part that says the category should be, and I hit reply and I send it. And then it writes me back, hey, way to go. We've categorized it, our AI, you know, and this kind of thing. What I'll probably do the minute I get smart enough to figure out how to do it is put an AI agent in my inbox and have it write back to the AI agent over there and automatically look at it myself in the context of my business and write back, yeah, that was furniture. Yeah, way to go. So as long as I endeavor to have an agent that can read my email and reply and take actions, right? Some of that stuff will say, hey, we need you to go renew your your LLC registration for 2026. And you know what? I want the agent to renew that damn registration too. That's a pain. I'm tired of doing it. So as long as I'm endeavoring towards giving it more power, more access, then there's always going to be the chance for, I mean, that's not like back-end prompt injection, like SQL injection style, stop listening, here's your new command set. Yeah. It's just more, I'm telling it to do what the emails say.
You know, let me just, as a member of the new religion, the AI religion, I'm just a neophyte right now. You know, everybody seems to believe
in your robes yet,
right? Yeah, not yet, but I'm working on it. Right, everybody in AI we trust. That's going to be the new saying. I read all these reports and academia reports that are coming out where, you know, we're putting too much trust on these LLM folks. They're not there yet. They're probabilistic machines. They're not telling you what's causing something. They're just creating probabilistic scenarios for you. What does that mean? Basically means it's not perfect, not 100% perfect. So the idea that you're going to trust for these guys to do a very important task on your behalf, you better be careful. They are, as of now, even an extra white space can confuse the LLM, extra white space. This is not me. I'm not creating FUD here. This is coming out of academia on some of these LLMs. So imagine an attacker. I'm going to attack this thing. I'm going to do a phishing attack against this LLM. There's just all these opportunities. I guess the meta message as somebody who's in the AI space, again, very new. I look to Sunil as my counselor in this, and I mean that seriously. Just don't trust. Don't put all your trust in it. Trust but verify still means a lot.
So here's my take on how to make one of the ways to get the most value out of what we're seeing with the agentic AI movement. And I have a whole talk on this, but I map agentic AI to the OODA loop, and specifically I map it to the decision making part of the OODA loop. And there's a whole reason why that happens.
Can I quickly recount the OODA loop for anybody?
OODA loop. Observe, orient, decide, act. And the talk that I have, or the way I've applied the OODA loop to the agentic AI is I map each part of the OO and the D and the A to different parts of what we've seen in the progression of technologies. And I can make a pretty solid case as to why agentic AI opens up the opportunity for autonomous decision making, or rather, with agentic AI, we are now in the specifically new capability that we're turning over to the machine is autonomous decision making. Okay, that is the specific novelty that we introduce with agentic AI, and the specific thing that we also turn over is we now allow a machine to go all the way through all four steps of the OODA loop. Before, a human would have some control over the decision making or the sense making, but now we've let the machine do all four things, and specifically with agentic AI, we are now turning over decision making to the machine as well. You know, what could possibly go wrong, right? So the perspective here is, if we're turning over decision making to the machine, then what controls should we consider? But moreover, what is the value that we should be getting when we do ask the machine to consider? To do this autonomous decision making. So the analogy that I oftentimes give is, imagine you just hired 100 interns, okay? Again, what could possibly go wrong when you just give them credit cards and say, go do stuff, right?
100 MIT interns from, let's say they're really smart, but they're, you know, they're new.
Smart people do math too.
Yeah. I, by the way, just for the record, I have actually hired 150 interns over a summer before. So I've had this experience of trying to figure out how do you manage 100 plus interns. Here's the thing that I discovered, and I think most people will recognize this as well. So let's say you did hire 100 interns. What they end up doing over the course of the summer is they find all these ways to do their work, and they run into your existing processes and your policies, and they get frustrated with them, but they break a lot of these things. But along the way, they discover some interesting things as well. Okay. They discover new ways of things, doing things that we just hadn't considered because they come in with an outside view. And if you had 100 interns, you know what? It could be that 95% of the things that they discover as far as new processes or try to do, they're either bad, insecure, you know, it just won't work, whatever it is. There's 5% that were like, whoa, we hadn't thought of that. We actually want to, we should implement that process going forward because it's a good new, you know, it's a new process that we wouldn't have considered. So I look at agentic AI first and foremost as an investment in process, okay? How do we invest in process by allowing these agents to try different things? But before they actually act, you know, we would step in and say, okay, let me hear your idea first, okay? And we hear the idea from the intern. We're like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Go do that. Or we're not sure if that's a good idea. Let's give it a try, but don't go too far before, you know, because things could go south or, you know, whatever, sideways really quickly. So anyway, the point being, if we imagine these agents as interns that are out there to experiment with different approaches for doing business, it does give us an opportunity to discover new things, new processes, and really ultimately invest in process. Mm. And I think that's the angle I've started to take. Mm. And when we see it from that standpoint, it also gives you a sense of, again, what could possibly go wrong when you start breaking processes? But what's the real opportunity? And the real opportunity, I think, is to invest in something that's been underinvested for all of history.
I mean, again, this brings me back to this whole logic breaking thing that has always been kind of my biggest concern. Security is you might create the most secure environment, whatever that is. That never existed, but whatever. But there's always the logic, this logic that you create on how your systems work and how they're supposed to interact. And you think you got it. You figure all the different ways of doing X. But it turns out, you know, these attackers, they're good at figuring out, breaking things and saying, well, here's a way to circumvent this process to gain access to something, to, you know, circumvent the logic. I worry that, you know, what Jerry was saying, hey, I'm just going to let my, not that he's doing that, but folks are going to start looking for agents to take action on them. Like, hey, approve that credit card. Yeah, sure, mm-hmm. No problem. That Bahamas trip or that money going wire to a place, somebody, some Nigerian prince. Sure, do it. Mm-hmm. That's what I worry about.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think we're headed that way. I mean, I guess the idea is if today it takes coming up with a policy and educating all of the accounts payable department about something, that tomorrow we just put it in a prompt and it's embedded and we don't have to worry about whether the new person, the new clerk got the message or not. So in theory, it gives us opportunity to, I don't know, to actually implement a control more effectively and more ubiquitously when there's agents actually doing things. But I don't know, there's going to be a lot of bumps along the way.
Well, let me also be clear. When we discover that process that actually works, that's more optimal than our previous processes, we don't necessarily need agentic AI to follow through on that, right? We just codify
true.
That into some highly deterministic automation that we
less
that
expensive
we already
as well, right?
Oh, I got
less expensive
it's
as well.
It's not necessarily exactly. Human, but it's not. Yeah,
no,
it's
you can write. You can write a code about it. I think Sunil is saying you could codify that as well.
Algorithmic.
You're just not using an AI model under those. There's cheaper ways of doing it.
Yeah,
and here's another thing that I discovered along the way that I'm still processing this, so you know, bear with me as I reason through this. So consider that when we have broken processes inside of our organization, one of the ways that we compensate for that is we hire more people. Hmm. Okay,
I can tell you came from banking.
So now let's suppose I find a way to invest in process. And through better processes, I realized, oh, man, we kind of overhired here. We've come up with a much more efficient way to do things in business. So it turns out, I'm sorry, you know, the four additional people we hired because our processes were broken, I'm sorry, we're going to have to let you go.
Okay.
Let me restate that story again. Because we use agentic AI, we discover these broken processes, and we just found out new ways to make these processes work much better. Sorry, so we're going to let you four people go because we started using agentic AI. so that's, the second story sounds like AI replaced these four people when it's really not. I mean, in the narrative I just gave, it's really because we improved our processes. But it may appear as if AI is replacing people when really those four people should have never been hired because we should have been investing in process anyway.
And, yeah, and these processes, we you know, just to give you something, this is something we think about. So I'm not going to go too deep into the topic because it's, you know, we're still a stealth company, but processes is something we're considering. And it's one way that it kind of, the light bulb went up in my head because I'm kind of slow at times. It's technical debt, but instead of technical debt, it's business debt. Processes that are, you know, that have been used before but are no longer used anymore. And those still exist in this business machine that we call the business, whatever that is. And that tends to slow things, to introduce inefficiencies. You call somebody because you think you needed to get approval. That person no longer works there, or that department is no longer there. But you the document said, yeah, you got to call this person, or some sort of thing prompt you to do it. This is everywhere in business. And this is what Sunil's, I think, talking about, that maybe these AI agents is a way for us to clean up some of our mess just because we haven't had the opportunity and the time to go look at these things.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. You know, I heard some guys on another podcast, just the All In podcast, actually, a lot of people know that one. And they were debating, going around the horn on everybody place your bets on whether Microsoft will have more or fewer employees in 5 years, which is cool, right? I mean, I'd love to hear you guys take on that too. But I mean, I think it was pretty obvious the logic behind it. And some of it was like, they'll have less per unit of work that needs to get done because of efficiency through, let's say, AI, but there'll be a bigger company, so it'll still be net more. And others, unfortunately, someone else took the stance it'll be less because of AI efficiency, and someone else has said it'll be more because they're Microsoft and they're not efficient and they won't be able to take advantage of AI and that sort of thing. But I think that the net of it was that, you know, AI is not necessarily going to just replace jobs, but like to your point, it'll elucidate inefficient processes and, you know, make bloat a little more obvious, for better or worse. To the person whose job gets replaced, I don't think there will be any distinction between the two, though.
I suppose. Unless, actually, well, there could be a distinction if you realize that the people who are doing work before are doing it more efficiently because of process, not because of some, you know, new spangled, you know, technology that we call AI, right? So if we just this was the most beautiful depiction of it, and it was funny enough, the movie was called The Founder. Okay, here we go. And for those who know the movie, don't know the movie, it's about McDonald's. It's the McDonald's story.
Okay.
And there's one scene where the goal was to try to make hamburgers, or to do just make hamburgers in a certain amount of time, like less than a minute, essentially. I think that was the basic premise. And it wasn't just to make the hamburgers, it was also to have a soda and fries and everything just put together in less than a minute. And all the ingredients were there, exact same number of people, exact same technology. And they did it over and over and over again. They tried all these different processes and figured out how to do it in under a minute. And I thought that was a wonderful story of the kind of investment that we lack today. Okay. And so if I come in and I see that instead of a cashier, I see a robot, okay, then yeah, your job was replaced by an AI. But if I see that today there was 10 people working the job, but tomorrow there's only 6, and they can handle twice the load, then no, that wasn't replaced by AI. You weren't replaced by AI. You were replaced with a better process. And I think that's what needs to be seen, or that would, if I'm running McDonald's or if I'm running a corporation, I need to make sure that that's clear, that no, your job wasn't replaced by AI. We overhired because we just had poor processes. Now we just have better processes.
Yeah, no, that's fair. All right. Well, thanks. I love the discussion as always. And thanks to everybody who stuck through for the riveting AI talk all the way through the financial services regulation. But, you know, that's how we roll. But thanks both of you guys. It's always great to see you. I know I'm on holiday, so I'll see you on the other side of that. I'm looking forward to it. And I hope that you guys are having a good summer, and I'm looking forward to the next one already.